So as you can realize, I'm not Pastor Peter, and he's gone for the next 2 weeks, and I'm pinch hitting for him, so I'm sorry about that, but you're stuck with me for 2 weeks. I love the college and career group over there. So speaking of college and career, I wanted to start this off with a pop quiz. Now, if you remember high school days or even before, pop quiz will just send tremors down your spine. Probably the two worst words you could ever put together. No one likes a pop quiz. And I know what you're thinking right now. Pastor's away. Where's Pastor? He doesn't do any pop quizzes. He usually tells a joke at the beginning. Well, we got a pop quiz. So I'd like to know if anybody, if we could go on the first slide here. This verse. I didn't say it was going to be easy. Actually, this is so easy that every single one of you knows this verse by heart. No, not Jesus wept. You're getting close. The second one of those two. How about this one? We got one more. Let's try another one. The golden rule. Anybody know the golden rule? Let's have the golden rule put up here. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. So when I was in second grade, and maybe you guys have similar remembrances of this, but when you first heard the golden rule or figured out what it meant, second grade, Mrs. Schneider's class, my favorite teacher, on the back of the wall, there was this huge words, do to others as you've had them do to you. I had no idea it was in the Bible. I had no idea it was from Jesus. I just thought that was just a nice thing people said to each other when you're in second grade. It was kind of nice because it had the ruler ticks on it, looked like a big ruler, you know, rule, little play on words. Anyway, so I had no idea that that was even in the Bible till way later. And, of course, once being a Christian, growing up in a Christian home, eventually I figured that out. And I just thought, wow, this is great. They're, like, throwing Bible verses all over the place at school and whatnot. What a great thing. Well, I've, had a lot of experiences like any of us have. And you start to see sort of, although you've known this verse, you didn't realize you had a verse memorized. You have one. So even though you've known this rule and you think and you kind of understand it, what we're going to try to do today is unpack what it really means and how it applies to different sections of our life and how I think if we can double down on this, it really is sort of the summing up the law. So the law, if anyone's wondering what that's talking about, a good chunk of the beginning of the Old Testament is about the rules that the Jewish people had under God. This was before Jesus. So it was like how these Jewish people are going to live in this land and how they're going to worship God and do the right thing. So God gave very specific laws. Well, Jesus is saying, look, if you want to sum all those things up and all the things the prophets said and basically the Old Testament, here it is. And so I think what a great verse to just focus on and figure out how it applies to different things. So you wonder, like, why is this thing called the Golden Rule? Well, Google will tell you very quickly that in 200 AD, so 200 years after Christ, a Roman emperor named Alexander Severus, he wasn't a Christian, but it was about the time in the Roman Empire where they stopped hating Christians and throwing them in lions' dens. And they started saying, well, they're okay. They're kind of doing good things for society. And so he wasn't a Christian. Roman Empire wasn't Christian. But he said, that is such a good phrase, the golden rule, that I'm going to have it etched in gold on my palace. So that was how it got the name, the golden rule. So got something to walk away with. So I guess the question is, when did you first hear this rule? And how have you applied it? So I think there's a couple of interesting things about this. One is it says, so in everything, do to others. So it's not just saying, oh, people that you're friendly with, maybe people in your family, maybe people who you're married to. It's talking about everybody. So we're talking to anybody you meet, anyone you have a side relationship with. Those are the ones that we're supposed to do this way. So have you guys ever screwed up really bad? Done something you wished you hadn't? Just regretted the heck out of it? And you said, like, man, I just hope whoever I injured in this thing, whoever knows that I really screwed up, that they take it easy on me. Have you guys ever been in that situation? I seem to find myself in that situation constantly. So you make a big mistake and you're just hoping that they go easy on you. But what happens when we have someone who's injured us somehow, or that we're responsible for, that screws up really bad, or that they make a decision that impacts us dramatically? What's our first reaction? It's usually to squash them, to make sure they know how much we're injured, to make sure that we settle the score. But is that what we want, ever? I don't think so, right? And so I think, although this is a simple rule, it's really hard to apply. Because when we get our gander up, when we get our righteousness on, that these people hurt me, and the reality is we got tons of situations where we messed up and screwed up somebody else's life or their attitude or their day or whatever it is. And they're just, you know, they're kind of like, they're hurting and we've hurt them. But when they show us grace, when they say, no big deal, it happens, and they love us straight through it, isn't that just an amazing experience? You can probably think of situations in your life where that's happened. I love to tell a story about my friend at the Brick Alley Pub in Newport, which is a restaurant maybe you guys have heard of or seen or whatever. It's a pretty famous one in Newport. Anyway, when I was a young architect, about 20-something years old, it was one of my first projects where I was totally in charge. No boss man over my shoulder. It was just me and the client. And I was loving it. The guy was super nice, and we were doing the second floor addition to the Brick Alley Pub. So I'm going at it. I've drawn this stairs that's going to connect the first floor to the second floor, and I'm all excited about how great this is that I get to work on this. And owner's great. He's had me over to his house. Just wonderful. Well, I get this call. Spence, the stairs you drew, which was pretty much my primary thing that I was supposed to do, are completely wrong. They don't fit in the space. The opening's too small. The stairs are going to go way into the bathrooms. You got to get over here immediately. Just sweating, right? Like that hair in the back of your neck kind of business. I'm just like blown up by it. And I think, oh man, I've totally screwed this thing up. I thought I had it right. What did I have wrong? Maybe I measured something wrong. So I run over there and I measure everything up again. And I come back and I spend, I think it was a whole night, just trying to figure out another way we could reconfigure the stairs so that everything would work. And I finally sort it all out, and I come back, and it's going to mean we need a beam over here, and we've got to stop work, and the contractor's all upset, and the owner, I'm just assuming, is just totally just going to kill me and kick me off the job and get a real architect to show up and do this. So I'm just waiting for that call. So the next day, you know, the call comes in, and the secretary buzzes me. It's Ralph Plum on line one. And, of course, my heart just stops because I'm like, here it is. I'm dead. I don't know. I can't really change anything now. Hey, Spence, it's Ralph. Oh, how you doing, Ralph? Yeah, thanks for helping out on the stairs. And we're going golfing this week, and I was wondering if you wanted to join our foursome, and we'll have a day where we can come out and golf with me and three of my buddies at this fundraiser event that we're doing. And I almost couldn't hear what he said, right? It was just like, what? Are you sure? Yeah, I like to golf, I'm saying, quivering. And so we go and we play golf with him. He never mentions a thing again. He hired me to do his house. He hired me to do this and that. And I work for his kids now, and every time I see him around town, like, gives me a huge hug, and every single time I think of the grace that he showed me, because there is no reason why he needed to treat me like that. He could have easily said, you know, we gave you a chance, Spence, but, you know, Let's get somebody else in here that can figure this out. And so I think that all of you have stories that are danced around your head that are similar to that, where someone showed you grace when there was no reason they needed to. But yet, if we apply this, that's what we want. I mean, we know we need to be held accountable when we screw up, no doubt. But when someone lets us off, when someone gives us grace, which is not giving us what we're due, that's pretty amazing. Another biblical reference is you got Peter, right? The main rock star disciple. And, you know, Jesus tells him, look, you're going to deny me 3 times before we get out of this mess. And he's never would I do that. You know, we're talking 24 hours, not like later or years later. 24 hours later, Peter's denied him 3 times. And what does Jesus say to him after they get the whole thing sorted out? And after Jesus returns, he says, Peter, you're still going to be my rock. He greets him, he kisses him, he hugs him. This is a guy who just a few days ago had said, I don't know that guy. I'm totally out of here. I don't have anything to do with that guy. So Jesus, and you know, we talk about me losing the job and the Brick Alley pub job or whatever, and I'm sure you guys have similar stories. Jesus' example is, I'm going to die for you, and all I'd like you to do is just acknowledge me. And Peter couldn't do that. Now that's one of the big guys. That's one of the tenets of our faith, is Peter and how strong he was and what a solid rock he was for the church. And here's someone who screwed up just as bad as any of us could have or would have. So I'd like to go, I dug a little deeper into the Golden Rule, and turns out there's a lot of other philosophers and other religions that use the Golden Rule as a base. Now, their Golden Rule is slightly different, and I just like to point it out. I think it was kind of neat because when I first started studying up on the Golden Rule, I saw all this stuff on the internet where, did Jesus plagiarize this? Was it something that was already out there? And for sure the concept is out there, but I'd like to go through a couple of other religions and the way they phrase it, and we'll see if we can spot the differences. So I think that's the next one. Hindu religion. This is, I don't even want to pronounce where the Mabar Habar Habata is, but this is the sum of duty. Do not to others, which if done to thee would cause thee pain. All right? Buddha said, hurt not others with that which pains yourself. Okay, let's keep rolling. Jewish tradition. What is hateful to you, do not to your fellow man. That is the entire law. The rest is commentary. Muslim. No one of you is a believer until he desires for his brother that which he desires for himself. And how about some old school ancients here? We got Socrates. Do not do unto others what angers you if done to you by others. And Confucius, right? We've all heard that guy. What you do not want done to yourself, do not do to others. So all of these are written, and you say, well, that's pretty close. That's kind of the same concept. And it is, but I read in a commentary, the difference is that all these are in the negative. So it's saying, don't do stuff to other people that you wouldn't have done to yourself. That's an easier standard than what Jesus threw out. And the difference is that if you just don't do bad things to other people, then that'll be great because you won't want bad things done to you. Jesus says it actually differently, and it's in the positive. So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law. So this is a proactive thing instead of a reactive thing, which is just what the Bible sums up. Instead of saying, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, which is what all these guys are saying, he's saying, you need to do it. You need to be active in this. That's a huge difference. It's one thing to say, I'm not going to mess with anybody and just live in your own little cocoon and not mess with anybody and not do bad things to people. It's another thing to say, I'd love it if someone came up to me and extended grace. I'd love it if someone came up to me at church and said hello. I'd love it if someone just stopped by unannounced and said, hi, hey, man, I'm thinking about you. And doesn't that make you feel great when someone goes out of their way, they don't need to do it, they come over to you and they say, hey, how you doing? Good to see you. What's going on with this, that, and the other in your life? Doesn't that make your day? It's one thing, but they could just drive by, right? That would fulfill all these other guys and the way they thought about the golden rule. Totally different with Jesus. Jesus says, no, 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 you got to go to people. You have to do things. You have to do what you would do to other people so that it's how you would want to be treated. So I think as you take stock in your life and you see things that bring you joy, when you see an interaction with a fellow human being that you think, wow, that guy is something else, you need to take stock of that and say, I need to do that. I need to repay that. I need to do unto others as God, as I'd like to be done to me. So all this is really hard. I think we get that in any of the Bible verses. In fact, every time I go to church, every time I read the Bible, every time I try to speak on anything, I try to think, how can I be encouraged and how can I be challenged at the same time? And I would challenge you to do the same whenever you come to church. Try to figure out how you're encouraged by it and how you're challenged. Because if you just walk into church or walk into the Bible or walk into any of these things and think, I'm just going to coast along here and hopefully this thing makes me feel good and then I'll get out of here, that's okay. But there's something when you walk out and you're challenged and encouraged at the same time. And I think the Bible is written to do that exact thing, challenge us and encourage us. And so I think this passage does it in so many ways. One, it gives us a clear, easy-to-understand direction that a 4-year-old can understand, but a 60-year-old has trouble implementing. So it's really a difficult thing to do, and I don't think we can do it on our own. You may say, well, this sounds like a good thing, Spence. I'm going to go apply this. This sounds good to go. But once you start doing it and applying it to the difficult situations in your life, for the people who rub you the wrong way, for the people that you don't feel like being nice to, when you try to do that over and over again, you'll find that it's tough to do it in every way. And the only way we can do it is striving this way with God's power, not us, that we need to be transformed to do this. Now, I thought about three different relationships that I thought the golden rule could apply to, and we have, I think, three different tiers of friends / relationships in our life. And I think we got a slide to go along with that. Can you go down three or four to three relationships? There we go. I got some Bible verses. I'll pop back to those, or maybe out of order. So the three relationship types that I could think of that we could apply the golden rule to are, I can't even see these because there's a forest of sharks in my way, acquaintances, or first time, people you've met for the first time or second time that you're new to. We got friends and family, and then marriage. The marriage relationships. So I'm sure there's some others in there, but these kind of cover the ones that I could think of. And then what I'd like to do is just go over how we can apply these lessons to those scenarios. So anybody here in high school right now? Nobody? Anybody here have been through high school? So you remember high school. Some negative, most negatively, I guess I would say. Some positively. I had some really great, funny guys that I went to high school with, and all I remember is just laughing hysterically. I don't remember studying. I don't remember anything else. But I do remember that the trials of junior high school and high school are really tough because kids are just crazy kids, right? Every kid's a little weird, and trying to fit in this time when you're changing and awkward and emotions are running high, it's a tough time to be alive, right? You've got to kind of, you're going to get hurt in high school, right? There's just, someone's going to make fun of you. You're going to be in the in crowd, the out crowd, the good crowd, the bad crowd, whatever it is. Those are tough, trying times. Anyway, I was going through, must have been something like that, somewhere around my junior year. and you know, someone didn't like me or whatever it was, and I was talking to my mom about it and saying, yeah, this guy, you know, used to be my friend, but now he doesn't like me and he hangs out with this guy, you know, the things that people talk about when they're in high school. So I'm sharing this, and my mom says, well, I think you should read this book. So she hands me a book that would look so worn that it could have been like the original Bible. It had things falling off of it. It was threadbare. I could barely read the title of it. It was clear that my mom, I assumed that she had read it so many times that she'd basically worn the thing out. Well, it was Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. Now, if you're a little older than I am, that may sound very normal, like you've heard that title before. I had never heard that title and thought, How to Win Friends and Influence People? This sounds like a scam artist book. What's my mom got me reading? I don't need to win friends. What the, you know, when you're in high school, you just think people are my friends. I don't win them. And Influence People sounded like something was afoot here and like someone was messing with somebody. So begrudgingly, I started to read it. Now, in high school, I don't know if you guys were like this, I didn't want to read. I was an athlete. I read stuff for a test, maybe, but just reading to read, no thank you. So I would start reading this book every night around, whatever, 10 o'clock, and I would fall asleep about two pages into it. Maybe you guys can have similar situations that you've been in. Anyway, for whatever reason, I just ground through this book and kept reading it, and it started getting more interesting and more interesting. And basically, there's a number of principles in there, but it was a guy, Dale Carnegie, a Missouri guy. Where are my Missouri people? Well, they're not here. One. A Missouri guy from the Midwest who started his life as a salesman and trying to had his positive and negative experiences, moved to New York City, and found that his real love was teaching other people how to be salesmen, how to talk to people, how to interact with people. And he kind of had this groundbreaking book that had a lot of impact to a lot of people called How to Win Friends and Influence People, and he then developed all sorts of sales technique kind of things. The good thing about him is he was a Christian, and almost every one of his people response issues were drawn right from the Bible. So I read the book, and I've read it numerous times since, but there's all sorts of like taglines to, this is how Jesus did it, this is how we can do it, and so on and so forth. The golden rule is sprinkled throughout this book. So it's really not like a sales how-to book. It's really just how to work and deal with people. Well, as a junior in high school, I needed that so bad because I didn't know how to deal with anybody. I didn't understand how to have conversations. I didn't understand all these sort of basic things that we take for granted now. But for me as a junior in high school, I didn't have any of those skills, and it was really, really eye-opening and a life-changing experience to read this book. And I'll sum it up for you, at least the one that I want to draw on for today, is anybody know what other people's favorite subject is? Themselves. themselves. So that sounds like, okay, everybody's interested in themselves. That sounds very self-centered, but isn't it true, right? We like talking about stuff that we like. Not a huge stretch there. But it's amazing how we miss that so often. And so I'd just like to bring up, which I think Dale Carnegie does a great job in his book of really unpacking this in a deeper way, but it's basically just drawing out the golden rule and making it applicable. And that is that when you interact with somebody, the secret of interacting with them is talking about them, not you, even though you want to talk about you. So I think, and that, you know, as a, you know, junior in high school, that's like the world just collapsed around me because all I knew was me and all I wanted to talk about was me. So what a change that made in my life when I was able to start applying that on a daily basis and just testing it out with my friends. Man, this guy's right. Every time I talk to another person and start talking about what they like to talk about, hey, they talk for hours. It's a great conversation. It's lively. We high five at the end. It's wonderful. And then we walk away. And Dale Carnegie would say, it'll be amazing what you'll see people light up when you dig around in conversation to find out what they're interested in. And I have a buddy, Aaron Fanoff, who is amazing at this. And when he talks to somebody, you'd swear you were on a talk show, right? Where there's a guest, and the talk show doesn't talk about them. They ask these sort of fun, leading questions to that person to sort of dig around and find out what's exciting to them and what's exciting. And we all watch it. We watch this all the time. So you could take cues from that very easily. Just watch any talk show and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Anyway, my friend Aaron is a rock star at this. He can talk to anybody about anything. And the beauty is you don't have to just talk about things that you find totally boring. What you can do is talk about things that you also find interesting, because I guarantee if you talk to a person long enough and ask enough questions, you'll find something that both of you are very interested in as well. Maybe something you don't know much about that you've always wanted to know about, and so on and so forth. And you can have amazing conversations. So that's a way of treating somebody else as you'd want to be treated. And I know it's very simple, but I think it gets lost all the time. So if you can try to apply this, it makes a huge difference. It made a difference to me, and it's made a difference to me my whole life. And I get people telling me, like, oh, it's so easy, Spence. You just talk to people this way. I'm like, it's not tricky at all. It's this simple little principle, the golden rule applied this way, that gets you to be able to talk to anybody about anything and have a good time doing it, as long as you put yourself in the back and put that other person up where you can talk about their interest. You will be able to talk to anybody at any time. So I think that's an amazing way that the golden rule can be applied to people. Now, I do think that it can go a little bit off the rails. And I read a few commentaries about how maybe Dale Carnegie's thing wasn't quite a Christian principle, because there clearly are times when you're talking to somebody, and we'll get into this in the next few relationships, where you hear things that aren't quite right, and you need to talk to them about something that isn't just about that. Maybe you have to confront someone about something. But there are ways to do that in love and not just hammering someone. But there are clearly times when there's a rub and you need to address an issue and so on like that. So we're not saying that you're fake and that you're just talking about them all the time. There clearly are times. But I think we can have a lot more of the love and talking about other people and probably less of the condemnation, or when we have to do situations where we have to talk to people about things that are not great. And so I wanted to then move to the second group of relationships, which is friends and family. This can be the maybe more difficult situation, right? It's one thing to meet somebody on a plane, chat with them for a while. You know this relationship's going to come to an end as soon as the plane touches the ground. And you can have those sort of shallow relationships, for lack of a better word, and you can ask all kinds of questions about them and be wonderful. But when it's friends and family, it's kind of different, as we know, right? Long-term friends and family can get tricky, right? Because you know everything about them, and you know this relationship isn't going to go away in a few hours when you land on the plane, and you need to do things differently. Well, anybody here, this is the Ocean State. Anybody here like boating or going out on boats? Yeah, a few. Yeah, well, you're in the right state. So I have had a few boating scenarios that none of them seemed to turn out that well. But one in particular was a bunch of my buddies. One guy owned like this mediocre powerboat. By mediocre, I mean it wasn't that nice looking or driving. And like a Saturday afternoon, they said, hey, let's go to Block Island. So I don't know where Block Island is. I'm from the Midwest. Okay, this guy must know where that is. So we jump on his little powerboat. It's like a ski boat kind of thing. And we drive all fun and games all the way to Block Island, which was probably about 2.5 hours by boat. And even though you can kind of see the shoreline in the distance, you're out in the middle of the ocean in this tiny little boat, which is a little bigger than this. And you start to, I don't know if anyone's been in this situation, but if you've been in a small boat and you can't quite see land anywhere, you start to realize that any screw up in this situation, any problem you come across, isn't going to be good. It's not like pulling over to the side of the road and saying, well, we'll wait till a police comes by and check us out. When you're in the middle of the ocean, it's a different world. And I think sometimes when you are dealing with friends and family, you got to imagine, and sometimes we've been in this situation in life too, you're in the ocean, in a picture of it, without being able to see land. So you're sort of at drift. And so the Block Island story, we got out there. We didn't make any provisions of where we were going to stay. We just winged the whole thing. We slept on the boat, tied up to another boat, and no one could sleep, and it was awful. But on the way back, it was early Sunday morning, and actually I was going to Living Hope. It was early Living Hope days, and I was singing in the choir. I know everyone's glad that I don't do that anymore, but I did at that point, and I said, guys, I got to be back for this thing, so we got to wake up early. We got to drive all the way back. Well, it was foggy like you can only believe. In fact, you couldn't see anything. You couldn't see land. And when you're driving in the ocean and you can't see any land and it's thick fog all around you, you could be going up, down, sideways. You don't know which way you're going. We had these little, this is before GPS, had this little compass on the boat, and that was all we had to go by. And I was like, who cares if we don't get home for the choir? They're not going to miss me. We're going to be glad when this thing is actually, when we see land. And I think we spent about 4 or 5 hours just driving, hoping we were kind of going in the right direction, assuming that we were going to not. But I thought, man, this is some scary stuff out here. You mess up on the water when you're out in wherever, it's a bad situation. Things can go south really fast. So why I lead into this is that a couple years ago, I don't know if you remember, it would be great if you've been in this situation and you're adrift in the ocean and you're not sure, you're getting a little scared. Wouldn't it be great if you were really in trouble if you saw this next slide? Oh, one more. I knew I'd get a laugh out of you somehow. If you saw the Coast Guard come and you were just in total trouble and all of a sudden you heard the beating of choppers and here comes the cavalry to come save you from who knows what was going to happen to you out there on the water. And a couple years ago, the Coast Guard had a slogan. I'm going to make sure I get this right. When things are at their worst, we're at our best, right? And I just thought, wow, that's a great phrase for them, because you can imagine if you ever need the Coast Guard, you really need the Coast Guard. You don't kind of need the Coast Guard. And so you think, like, if you treat your friends and family like this, like if you think about that slogan, which I think is so perfect for them and probably for us too, we should have grabbed that slogan before the Coast Guard did as Christians, and say, friends and family, when things are at their worst, I'm going to be at my best. I'm going to run toward the problem instead of try to get out of the problem, and realize that everybody's got problems. And heck, wouldn't we want, when we're adrift in the ocean without anybody, that someone comes running toward us instead of away from us? Man, that's when the golden rule starts making a lot more sense. Is it fun? Is it great to do? Do we like doing it? Do we want to run towards somebody else's problem, let alone someone who's in our family or friend that's in a bunch of tough water? I don't think so, but that's what God's called us to do by this golden rule. And that's when it gets tough. That's when it's a little harder than just, oh, man, I'll do that to people I meet on the bus, but I'm not going to do it to folks that are really in part of my life in that real way. So next is marriage. And I've been married for 13 years, something close to that. My lovely wife, Michelle, is here with Brady, and she has put up with my nonsense for 15 years at least. And that's a lot of nonsense to put up with when you got 15 years of it. But I am very happily married, and I'm realizing that marriage is not just a one-time situation. You stand up there, you pledge your vows, and then you're hitched up. I'm realizing that it's a continual evolution of changing and learning, and there's the honeymoon phase, and then there's the next phase, and the next phase. And I'm in the phase right now, 10 plus years out from being married, with a bunch of friends who all got married around the same times, that everybody's got a couple of kids, everybody's been married for 10 to whatever years, everyone's got their career going, and marriages take a total toll right at this point. We get calls probably every month of one of our friends that are contemplating divorce, and I just, we see it, we live it with them, we're part of that situation when our friends are going through this thing, and it is just terrible. Just what it does to the kids, what it does to each other, taking two totally rational, fun people and turning them into the opposite of that. And I had a buddy of mine, and I've shared this with a few people, so pardon me if you've heard this story before, but a buddy of mine called me, longtime college friend, and said, well, Amy's told me that she wants a divorce, and we're going through three or four other divorces at the same time, and I basically just said, you can't do it. You can't let this happen. I'm seeing the other side of it in some of these other friends, and you just can't do it. We've got to figure something out. He's not a Christian. I think he's as far away from being a Christian as you can imagine. But right at the time, about last summer, Pastor gave a marriage sermon using the book Love and Respect by, make sure I get his name right. Emerson Eggerichs. The book's called Love and Respect. Well, I thought, well, I'm going to go try to read this book just for my friend so I can give him some opinion, because I didn't really know what to tell him. I'm not a marriage counselor. I don't know if I'm doing a good job in my own marriage. So I'm going to read this book, and it sounded good. And so I read the book, and as I read it, I thought, I'm in trouble in my own marriage the way I'm acting right now. This is maybe bad for me that I'm reading this book and seeing like the way that I'm acting and the selfishness that I'm exhibiting. But what is funny about that book, or what's interesting, is that the golden rule sort of gets misapplied in our marriages, I feel like. And so we're used to understanding the golden rule as, if I want it to happen to me, I'm going to do that same thing to my spouse. And it turns out in a deep marriage relationship, I guess, and even in close friends situations, the same thing happens. How you internalize love is not the same as your spouse does. So guys have to figure out how to treat their wives differently than they want to be treated. And that really unlocked a lot to me, because I would always do, well, I'm doing all these nice things to my wife that I would like. How come she's not happy about it? Guess what? She's not me. So she doesn't act the same way. And Emerson's book, Love and Respect, really covers that in a really finite way, where he applies all these things. And it's really sort of amazing to unlock the ability to pull someone, your spouse, out of a funk that they're in, or maybe you're in a tough situation with your spouse. And the beauty and the hope that this book lies in is that it doesn't matter if only one of you wants to fix the marriage. So that, I always thought, well, you got to get both people on board before anything's going to happen. He says, no, typically, it's usually one person that's trying to battle to get the marriage back together, and the other person's sort of out to lunch about it. And so that was really hopeful, because I thought my buddy John was in that same situation where he felt like he was the only one who wanted to keep the marriage together. And so reading this book and getting into it really helped me. But I feel like there's parts of the golden rule that you need to really analyze, because just because you want certain things to happen to you doesn't mean that that's how someone else is going to actually receive love or respect in that way. And the book really tries to highlight that women, wives, are interested in having them be loved, and men are more on the respect side. And that is clear when you read through the two different ways that that is applied. It really is clear that, you know, I read the list of things that the woman can show respect to the man, and I think, yeah, these are all great things. Like, you know, tell me how great I am, and I'm taking care of the family, and I'm providing, and I'm tough. And I'm like, yeah, I want to hear all those things. And my wife read those lists, and she said, these are all silly. And I'm like, I think that's the point. I think, and same with me. I read all the things that I was supposed to share and say and ways that I could show love to my wife. And I thought, these are all kind of silly. And she's like, I think that's the point. You need to, you know, so we need to apply the golden rule in a little different ways when it comes to that. And so, just to follow up on that, and I just want to talk about that book a little bit more because I think it's worth repeating, is that when a husband and wife are, you get offended or hurt, and then your reaction is to offend and hurt back, and then the reaction back is to offend and hurt, you can imagine how that starts creating a situation where it's spiraling out of control. And you hear things like, well, we've grown apart, and we don't really enjoy each other's company, and we don't do this, and we don't do that, and my needs are not being fulfilled. I hear that all the time with all my buddies and their wives that are going through it. And I think, wow, what a tough situation that is, that these people who loved each other so much and could love each other can. And Eggert's book basically talks about how you can change that dynamic by being selfless, by applying the golden rule and saying, I'm going to give my wife, I'm going to give my husband what they want, what they deserve. And a lot of times, for me, I was kind of clueless about that. I was just doing things that I thought I'd want to have done too. And why it wasn't working, obviously, was pretty obvious. So the golden rule principle and the depth that this principle has, I think, have applications all over the place. And I think if you really try to apply this to your life, whether you're in high school, whether you're 60 and bickering with your spouse, whatever it is, and all the way in between, there are so many applications where we can say, I'm going to do to somebody else what I'd like to have done to me. And that'll change the game completely. And we can't do it on our own. God is the one who takes us, changes us, and allows us to see it. And even allows us to see how applying that, the way I serve love to somebody else may not be exactly how I want to, but it's how they want to. We want to get love shown to us how we like it. So you have to know that person. You've got to ask them, and you've got to be intuitive about it. Let's pray. Lord, we can't do it on our own. We screw it up almost every time. We need your support. We need your love. We need that constant contact with you that shows us where other people are hurting, where it shows us what we should do, whether it's what we would do normally or not, but how we can show love to somebody else through little ways of talking about what they're interested in, all the way to laying down our lives in a way that is selfless. You showed us that time and time again in your life and your words and even in the Bible through Paul's letters, that it's not about us, ever. It's always about you, and it's always about laying down our life for somebody else. We need your help to do that. We pray we can apply these things in a real way this week and forward. We thank you for this church and what you've done for us. We pray for Pastor and his family. In Jesus' name, amen.